This is Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Simon Strauss in Lenox, Massachusetts on August 24th, 1994. You were just beginning to discuss the Tocopalla, Southern Peru Copper Corporation. Well, it wasn't Southern Peru Copper Corporation yet, but
that's correct.
The Tocopalla project in Southern Peru.
When Mr. Sarah Pasco failed to make a deal for the property, the owner went to the Northern Peru Company,
which was
a subsidiary of ASARCO, and suggested that ASARCO might be interested. ASARCO did a little exploration before the war, but during the war that work was suspended. It was resumed in 1946. The outcome of the exploration convinced our people that we had a viable major copper deposit in Tocopalla. By 1951, we decided to apply to the Export-Import Bank for a loan to help us develop the deposit. It was clear at that time that at least $100 million would be needed to develop this deposit, because it was located at an altitude of 9,000 feet in the Peruvian Andes, roughly 100 miles from the sea coast. The logical way to develop the mine was as an open pit mine with a concentrator there, and concentrates would have to be transported down the mountains to the seashore, where it would seem appropriate to build a smelter.
There were no roads going in there.
There were no roads going in. There was virtually no population. It was an arid mountain area. The only sizable community was the little fishing village of Ilo, I-L-O, which seemed appropriate for a smelter site if and when we went ahead. So it was going to be a huge investment. And while ASARCO was happy at the time with the political situation in Peru, it did not have the resources to put up all of the cash required. It was clear we would have to borrow it from someone. During the very early days of the Korean conflict, Export-Import Bank indicated it was receptive to making loans for development of additional copper production, and so the preliminary discussions were had with Ex-Im Bank. However, before these had gotten very far, the Korean crisis began gradually to look less ominous. The administration's eagerness for additional copper production cooled off somewhat. The fact that it would take a long time to build the facilities indicated slowed the negotiations down. And then following Mr. Eisenhower's election in 1952, he got a new Secretary of Treasury, Mr. Humphrey, from the M.A. Hanna Company, I believe.
This is not Hubert Humphrey.
No, George Humphrey. And George Humphrey was not too sympathetic to the idea of lending U.S. taxpayers money for construction of foreign projects abroad, and he declared a halt to any such loan.
Was the Ex-Im Bank still in your building? Were you neighbors?
Well, I wasn't in that building any longer, but it was in the building that I had worked in during the war, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was thinking, oh, okay.
I worked in that building during the war, but when I left the government,
did you have
I didn't
friends?
Work there.
I was wondering if you had friends.
Oh, I knew very well the former chairman of the Ex-Im Bank, a fellow named Warren Pearson, who had been chairman during the war years and with whom I had a lot of negotiations. But Pearson had left the Ex-Im Bank, mm-hmm. and I knew some of the personnel there. But this was not an issue that was determined by who you knew. This was a major policy decision for any government. So the negotiations were put on hold for a while. However, as the Cold War developed and other factors, and as Mr. Eisenhower had some interest in promoting better relations with Latin America, Ex-Im Bank was indicated that perhaps they should resume discussions of this. Because it was a major project, they sent their own engineers down to examine the deposit, to consider the advisability of the location of smelting facilities, whether a road should be built or whether a railroad should be built. Obviously, we needed some form of transport, and whether there was adequate water supply. It was a major undertaking in an area where there was no existing industrial activity of any kind. Finally, we got an indication from Export-Import Bank that they would be willing to put up between 50% and 60% of the cost of such a project if we were prepared to put up the balance. This created a very interesting situation, because up to that point, ASARCO had had no experience in open pit mining.
Now, we meant you and Cerro together, or just ASARCO?
No, no, Cerro wasn't in the thing. They had turned the property down.
Okay,
we had the property.
It was only ASARCO, all right.
Right. So the question was, without real expertise in open pit mining, what should we do? Roger Strauss and Kenneth Brownell decided that we needed a partner with a lot of expertise. Two American companies were the obvious candidates. One was Kennecott, the other was Phelps Dodge, as a joint venturer with us in the Tocopilla venture. We talked about it. There was one handicap with inviting Kennecott to be our partner, and that was that Kennecott was already operating a major project in Chile. Peru and Chile had fought a war in 1879, and while that war was long past, nevertheless, the two countries were not overly friendly. It seemed to us that to have a partner who was also operating in Chile might create problems. For example, in the event of a severe recession in the demand for copper, both properties were operating at normal rates, but it seemed desirable to avoid flooding the market with copper, to curtail production somewhat. Where do we curtail? If we curtail in Chile, the Chilean government will be angry. They'll be particularly angry if we are also running the Peruvian facility at full tilt.
Mm-hmm.
Vice versa. If we curtail in Peru, the Peruvian government will be unhappy. So it seemed to us that was an unnecessary burden to put on ourselves, mm-hmm. of bringing this latent hostility between Peru and Chile into the picture. Therefore, Mr. Strauss and Mr. Brownell went to see Lewis Cates, who was then the head of Phelps Dodge. Mr. Cates was very interested.
Now, their headquarters were in New York also.
They were in New York. Mr. Cates was very interested. He said, I will send my engineers down to look at this deposit. I'll look at all of your data. Interested in being a partner, but he said, I know that while you have been developing the Tocopilla deposit, Cerro de Pasco and Newmont have had a joint venture to explore another deposit called Cuajone, mm-hmm. that's Cuajone. Mm-hmm. And he said, I hear that they have had pretty good results.
And this was not far away.
It was 25 miles away. He said, I think it would be a grave mistake to set up a situation in Peru like the situation in Chile, where Anaconda and Kennecott are sort of played off one against the other by the government. And that is likely to happen if Guajone is actually brought forward by Cerro and Numa. Incidentally, we were well aware by this time that Cerro and Numa had also approached the Export-Import Bank for a loan. But we had approached Ex-Im Bank earlier. So Ex-Im Bank said to them, we're not about to finance two copper projects in Peru at the same time. We're working on a deal with ASARCO. If that doesn't go through, we'll be glad to talk to you. But in effect, ASARCO was here first, and we feel, in all fairness, we've got to take care of them. So Mr. Cates said, let's form a joint venture with all four companies involved, ASARCO, Phelps Dodge, Newmont, and Cerro. We'll go up forward with the Tocopala project because that's the one that has had the most study by the Ex-Im Bank. And the Guajone project can wait down the stream.
Kate suggested this after investigating it.
After his, the preliminary talk. He said it right at the outset.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. He said he knew about Guajone. Mm-hmm. And he just didn't want to go further with us until this issue was settled. Mm-hmm. Well, you can imagine we had four different companies headed by very strong-minded people. By that time, Bob Koenig was the, that's K-O-E-N-I-G, was the CEO at Cerro. Malazimov had just taken over as CEO at Newmont. Cates was at Phelps Dodge. Strauss and Brownell were in ASARCO. These were all strong-minded people, and each one knew reasons why his company was entitled to the lead thing. It took a long time to work out a deal. Finally, a deal was worked out under which ASARCO would have slightly more than half of the shares because we had the commitment from Ex-Im Bank because we would be the operators of the smelter, which was important because we were prepared to put up the management for the construction of the plant. Cerro felt they had a very strong claim. They felt they had looked at Tocopala first. They had found Guajone. They took about 20%. Phelps Dodge put in about 16%. And Newmont a little over 10. Those percentages have altered slightly over the years, but it's still roughly the basis of ownership of Southern Peru. So we went back to the Ex-Im Bank with this deal. Meanwhile, the estimated cost of the project had increased because it was clear that we should operate it at a somewhat higher rate than originally thought, which meant more capacity. Furthermore, if Guajone was going to be available, you could exhaust the Tocopala mine more rapidly because you'd have the other one to fall back on, which would use the same transport and smelter facilities as Tocopala would use. We were going to develop a major water source 53 miles away at a lake, Puno, at an altitude of 15,000 feet above sea level. We had to put in a pipeline to bring in enough water, not only for the processing in the mill, but for the community that was going to be built. So it was a vast undertaking, really. In today's dollars, it would probably have run $1 billion. But it was, the final figure came in at slightly over $200 million to produce 160,000 tons of copper a year with a railroad rather than a haul road. Malazimov argued strongly for use of trucks rather than rail. Phelps Dodge.
That is to the
port.
Port, right.
Well, and we need a rail connection between the mine and the concentrator, which would be close by, but nevertheless.
But they used trucks transport. In the mine.
They used trucks on the levels of the mine, but they, as at Bingham at that mm-hmm. time, mm-hmm. The trucks emptied into rail cars, and the rail cars went down to the concentrator. Mm-hmm. Bingham was, in a sense, a sort of a general model mm-hmm. for this project. The smelter would be at the coast. We needed power plant facilities. That would be built at the coast. There was nothing.
No
electricity, no water, nothing. So it was enormous in an area that had never had an industrial undertaking of any kind. And of course we had to build town sites. Yeah. We had to provide facilities not only for the staff, that is the professionals, but for the workers, both at the mine and mill and down at the smelter site, because the town of Ela was a miserable collection of run-down fishermen's shacks.
Mm. Incidentally, we visited there in the early 70s,
yes.
So I did see it.
Yes.
It was a very nice town site when they were through.
Yeah. You were both at Ela and Tokopawa?
We went to Tokopawa, and Lang went down to Ela, but I didn't get to Ela.
Right.
But,
yeah.
And it was, I think, 72.
Yeah. Which was before Quahoney was in operation.
Quahoney was being
under construction.
It was right, but it wasn't. There was no camp there yet.
Yeah.
The
Quahoney camp is even better than the Tokopawa camp.
I understand it is.
And the medical facilities, the schools, everything was far and above anything that the typical Peruvian worker was accustomed to.
First class.
And the railroad was very efficient, although Plato's may have been right that we would have been better off with trucks. Nobody will know.
Why was he so much in favor of trucks?
Well, because he felt that the rail facilities were sort of a permanent location. If you used trucks, if there was a problem with the road, you could have divergence. And mm-hmm. he just thought the truck transport would prove in the long run to be mm-hmm. less expensive.
But he was outvoted?
He was outvoted. Mm-hmm. As I say, PD had the operations with rails
mm-hmm.
between their mines and smelters. But for instance, they didn't truck their concentrates from Bisbee to Douglas. They shipped by rail. So.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the interesting thing about it was that this was a very efficient rail because the heavy traffic was from the mine down to the port. There was a lot of return traffic in the form of supplies and fuel and so on. But in effect, you were helped by gravity. I often used to joke, some of the tees on the golf course at Tokopawa, 9,000 feet above sea level, if you hit the ball right, it might roll all the way down to the Pacific Ocean. And one of the interesting things about the project was the use of seashells to provide the lime mm-hmm. required in the smelter. Did you know about that?
I guess not. No,
there was a major mining operation of digging up the centuries of seashells and were deposited up the coast, not very far from the Smelter, to be used to, for the lime.
Lovely, it's pure lime.
Coquina.
Mm-hmm.
That's C-O-Q-U-I-N-A. Mm-hmm. Well, it was 1955 before all of this was hammered out. The money raised, the contracts placed for the equipment. Construction started late 55, early 56. The first general manager was a chap named Doerr, D-O-E-R-R, who had been running one of the smelters in the United States. But some of the partners were dissatisfied. He wasn't pushing things aggressively enough. So in his place, he was replaced by E.M. Tippmann, who later became chairman of the board of ASARCO, and he was a dynamo.
Two N's in Tippmann?
Yes, and two T's.
Mm-hmm.
Ed went down and was the first president and general manager of Southern Peru Copper Company. Each of the four partner members had two, right to name two directors to the board of the company. But, and this affected me considerably, we made it clear from the start that if the board of directors got involved in questions of marketing policy, we would run athwart of the Justice Department. Mm. They would say, you are using Southern Peru as a way of collaborating to create price controls that might spin off into the U.S. market. So it was agreed by everybody that ASARCO would handle the marketing of the copper. Originally, we were to produce blister copper in Ilo and ship blister copper to refineries in the United States or in Europe. Some of the partners wanted all of the blister to come to the United States. Phelps Dodge had a refinery at Laurel Hill in those days in New York. ASARCO had refineries in Baltimore and Perth Amboy, which were logical places to handle the blister. Neither Newmont nor Cerro de Pasco had refineries in the United States, but they had strong ties at that time with the American Metal Company that operated the refinery in Carteret. And they made arrangements with American Metal under which any blister that was assigned to them by Southern Peru would be refined at American Metal's facilities. However, I felt very strongly that some of the blister, perhaps the majority of the blister, ought to go to Europe. The Peruvians would start to feel about Southern Peru, perhaps, the way the Chileans had felt about the Chilean copper that came up to the United States, was refined here and fabricated by subsidiaries of the owning companies in Chile. I felt that we should be selling blister in the open market. There are two large refineries in Europe. One was the plant at Hamburg, owned by Norddeutsche, that's N-O-R-D-E-D-E-U-T-S-C-H-E. And the other was the plant at Olen in Belgium, that's O-L-E-N, operated by the Societe, that's S-O-C-I-E-T-E, General, that's General with an E at the end of it, D-E-S, Minerai, M-N-I-N-E-R-A-I-S, or its affiliate, the name of which escapes me at the moment. First of all, by dealing with these European refineries, we would get processing terms which could be considered arm's length terms. Whereas if the Lister were sold to the parent companies for treatment in their own refineries, or in the case of Numancero, the Emax refinery, there would always be the suspicion on the part of the Peruvians that the charges for refining were excessive and dominated by the desire of the owners to earn profits outside of Peru from what was basically a Peruvian product.
Mm-hmm.
So that broad policy issue was agreed to. But beyond that, it was agreed by all the partners, and as far as I know, has never been deviated from, that the determination of the pricing methods to be used, where the sales are to be made when you have copper blister refined on a toll basis so that the copper is returned to you for sale, that determination should be in the hands of one of the partners, but not in the hands of the four. And since ENSARCO was the biggest partner and also had the best sales organization in Europe, Newmont, Phelps Dodge had none, Cerro had a rudimentary sales organization, basically the sales representative of American Metal. So it was agreed that American Smelting and Refining Company would handle the marketing, and that has consistently been the case.
Mm-hmm.
American Smelting and Refining Company has appointed somebody in the organization on behalf of Southern Peru to negotiate the refining terms with the other partners so that they would be uniform. We wouldn't allow Phelps Dodge to charge more than ENSARCO or Amex to charge more than ENSARCO or Phelps Dodge. We wanted uniform refining rates in the United States on the part of the United States partners. There may have been.
So some was sold in the States.
It was sold in the United States or converted on toll in the United States, but it did come to the United States. But for a long time, the bulk went to Europe.
Mm. How do you go about, is this sold through the commodity exchange? Or
no, it may be sold on the basis of commodity exchange contract, but it's sold to consumers. The refined copper is sold to consumers. The price named may be the price prevailing, and here we're getting into a very mm-hmm. vast subject, but it may either be the price prevailing on a given day on the commodity exchange, or in, this is in Europe, or the average price for a month. I always preferred to sell on the basis of the average price. I don't mm-hmm. think that you can pick specific dates.
Mm-hmm.
If you start picking specific dates, the customer will want the option of deciding which dates, and then you get into all kinds of controversy. So the average price for the month should be fair to both the buyer and the seller. And most of the copper has been sold on that basis. Now, in the United States, there have been periods when the price in the United States has been quite different from in the world market. And that has always been a sort of a tangled question, because the Peruvians obviously want the best price. They don't care whether it's in the United States or in Europe, but mm. they want the higher of the two, whatever it may be. In the United States, until after 1974, the domestic producers of copper selling to domestic consumers did not use commodity exchange prices. They nominated their own prices, which might be roughly the same as the commodity exchange prices, but at times were very different, and we'll get into discussion of that issue subsequently when we talk about some of the price control issues. But the Tocopala negotiation was very lengthy, very difficult, but proved in the long run to be a quite successful outcome. Actual production started in the end of 1959. The first year of full production was the year 1960. Tocopala operated at all times at capacity. The tons of copper produced gradually retreated as the better grade ores close to the surface were exhausted and we got into lower grade ores. First few years, the material treated was had a higher copper content than the average of the ore body. So the production gradually diminished from 160,000 tons, this is short tons, more or less a year, to the present level of between 100 and 120,000 tons. There have been some labor strikes, but except for that, Tocopala has operated continuously at or close to capacity over all this period.
And a fantastic thing.
It began in 1960. The bulk of the export-import bank debt was retired within the first 3 or 4 years.
Hmm.
However, a stub, I don't remember any longer, but I think the loan was either a 15 or 20 year period. About $5 million of that debt was kept in place over the life of the contract, simply because we wanted, in talking to the Peruvian government, to be able to say, well, you know, a United States government agency, the Export-Import Bank, is a lender to this organization, and we mustn't do anything which will get them too upset. Mm. Well, many things were done that did get them and got us upset, but that was a result of political developments.
So it was not taken over?
No. After Mr. Tittman returned to New York, which was about 1961 or 62.
I was wrong about when I was there. I think we were there in 69.
Maybe. Yes, that was shortly after the military junta had taken over in Peru, 69. Well, whatever the case is, after Mr. Tittman returned to the United States, these CEO of the operations in Peru was Frank Archibald, who had been with the Sarco at the Tacoma smelter and elsewhere. And he was a marvel at handling relations with the Peruvian government. And it was largely because of Mr. Archibald and the advice of people in the New York office, principally Charles Barber and Alexander Gillespie, the general counsel, that Southern Peru steered a course of action which prevented the Peruvian government from taking the we did lose one property of southern Peru, and we lost another property that Asarco had found in northern Peru. In addition to Cuajone and Tocopala, which were major ore bodies, during the exploration period after the war, Asarco engineers had identified a third deposit in the general area called Cuyavecco, that's Q-U-E-L-L-E-V-A-C-O. Cuyavecco was lower grade than either Cuajone or
V-A-C-O or V-E-C-O?
V-A. Cuyavecco. No, you're right. V. It's A-V-E-C-O. You're quite right. Cuyavecco was lower grade than either Tocopala or Cuajone, and it was somewhat smaller. There was over 200 million tons, however, of material running about.
And in the same region.
In the same region. Mm-hmm. As to describe their locations, Cuajone is to the east of Tocopala, about 25 miles. Keyaveco is about 15 miles northeast of Tocopala, mm-hmm. and about the same distance northeast of Quahuni. So they form a sort of a rough triangle.
Mm-hmm.
We identified the Keyaveco, but we had no plans to bring it into production because it was lower grade. It's a resource which we thought over the years would eventually be available, probably for treatment at the Tocopala concentrator when the Tocopala production began to have. Mm. The railroad would be extended up there, or a road would be extended up there, and the ore would be brought down and processed at Tocopala. However, when the military junta took over in Peru in 1969 or 68, I think it was 68, they said that it was not appropriate for mining companies to hold large deposits indefinitely. These resources belong to the Peruvian people. If the companies were not prepared to go ahead with the development of those resources, then they would revert to the state. Rather than get into an argument about Keyaveco, we did say that we already were making studies about bringing Quahuni into production, but we were not prepared to invest money also in Keyaveco. So the government took over Keyaveco, and only within the last few months they put it up for sale. Southern Peru made an offer for it, but was outbid by the Anglo-American interests through Minorco, you know their name, M-I-N-O-R-C-O, which already had property in Chile, the Montes Blancos copper mine in Chile. And so they now have the Keyaveco property, and they're looking at ways to get it into production. I can anticipate that perhaps, because of the logistics, in the long run, a deal will be worked out between Anglo-American and Southern Peru to make the transport facilities Southern Peru has, the water supply Southern Peru has, the milling capacity Southern Peru has available for Keyaveco.
Would be logical, wouldn't it?
Because it's the logical thing to do. It would be ridiculous for somebody to invest money in building a separate facility, considering the proximity of these deposits. The other deposit, which Sarco had an interest in, not Southern Peru, was in the north of Spain, north of Peru, near the town of Cajamarca, that's C-A-J-A-M-A-R-C-A, and it had the sort of amusing name of Michiquiay, that's M-I-C-H-I-Q-U-I-L-L-A-I, Michiquiay. This, unlike the Southern Peru properties, is in an area that is farmed by the local Indians. There would be problems about displacing them if Michiquiay was brought into production. It was fairly low grade, very large tonnage, probably 500 million tons, but well under 1% copper. And Sarco was not prepared to go ahead with that, particularly not with the political issue. So the government took it over and said, well, they'd find somebody else to develop it. Countless Japanese, Finnish, and other people have taken a look at it, but nobody has yet ventured to put put up the huge sums of money that would be necessary. This is a very historic area in Peru because it was at Cajamarca that the Spanish explorer Francisco Pizarro first met the Incas. And it will be interesting to see what eventually happens to Michiquillay. But it's one of literally dozens of Peruvian deposits which contain substantial quantities of metal. But that, the logistics, the difficulties of transportation, the climate, other problems.
As you've mentioned, the political situation sometimes is even more important than the supply and demand.
Correct. However, as an indication of the Sarcos' ability to get along with governments that take over other people's minds, Northern Peru has continued to operate as a small copper-lead zinc operation up at the Pura Vilca, which I mentioned earlier.
The Pura Vilca one they kept on their own.
Yes, they kept it. Maybe she's going out.
No, I think she just got it.
Hello? Yes? Northern Peru, the Pura Vilca mine. What has actually happened there is that a minority interest, 20%, has been sold to private Peruvian investors. It seemed desirable to us to have a Peruvian investor in this small mine, but it continues to operate. It produces copper, lead, zinc, and silver, and it has a substantial potential for expansion at some future date when the feeling is that this is an appropriate time to invest more.
You might be a little more specific about what Frank Archibald did that was so skillful.
Well, it was simply that he understood, first of all, he spoke Spanish well. He was originally born in Texas, I believe, but very close to the Mexican border, had a lot of business, I think lived for a time in Mexico. He understood the Latin temperament. A lot of Americans, from a cultural standpoint, don't understand really how to deal with Latins. Frank did. He always had very good relationships, for example, with the military officers who represented the southern region of Peru. There was always a small army detachment assigned to Tocopala or Guamoni. He got along very well with them. He knew how to talk to the labor leaders without getting them offended. And with the local politician, he kept in touch with the Minister of Mines, the Minister of Treasury, the people with whom the company had to deal. He never lost his cool. He never threatened. And he was well liked there. When I was arranging the annual the 50th celebration and the 50th anniversary celebration of the Copper Club last year, I, recognizing that Frank Archibald, who has since died, had been a Copper Man of the Year some years ago, I got in touch with his widow, hoping to have a picture of him that we could show at the time. Unfortunately, she didn't dig up any in time, but we did manage to find a picture showing Frank being decorated by the general of the Peruvian army with the highest decoration that approved in government gives to any foreign citizen. And this was after the junta had taken over and after the Cerro de Pasco operations and the W.R. Grace operations and Exxon's oil properties had all been taken over by the government.
That was a real compliment to him.
It was a compliment to him. Of course, one thing that helped a great deal was that when the junta came into power in the late 60s, we said we would go ahead with Quahoney. They knew they would have trouble raising the amount of money that was necessary to bring Quahoney into production. And so it was sort of a carrot that we were dangling in front of them. And we went ahead with it. The financing of Quahoney was a very difficult, extremely complex, and quite successful.
It wasn't the same as Tocopala.
No. First of all, we had to have $700 million instead of $200 million. Not because it was a bigger project, but simply because inflation had changed the value of money in the interim. What was needed to bring in Quahoney were three principal investments. One was the development of the mine and the construction of the mill, which is clear. Second was the expansion of the Ilo smelter so that it could handle twice as much material as it had. And the third was the extension of the railroad from Tocopala through the mountains to Quahoney. In theory, there could have been a railroad built that would have gone from Quahoney directly down to Ilo, down a different valley, but it would have meant that we had twice as much track to maintain and twice as much rolling stock, in effect. So instead of that, what was decided was to build a railroad from Tocopala to Quahoney, but there were intervening mountains, and I think something like two-thirds of that is tunnels. And this was a mammoth engineering job, and a huge investment to dig those tunnels through the mountains. It's 25 miles, as I said.
But what mountains?
And what mountains? And the experience, which I have had, of riding on the caboose of an ore train from Quahoney to Tocopala is quite interesting because you're in the dark most of the time. But it's well worth doing. And incidentally, in the tunnel, there is provision for bringing some of the tailings from the Quahoney mill running alongside the track over to Tocopala, where it joins the Tocopala tailings. And those are eventually disposed of in a riverbed, which is dry most of the year. And they come all the way down the river to the mouth on the Pacific Ocean. One interesting project, a nephew of Mauricio Hochschild, who was a very enterprising young man in the, he's not so young, but enterprising man in the metals business, mining business in Peru, actually has built a plant at the mouth of the river to recover copper concentrates, because the action of rolling down that mountain apparently creates a sort of a natural concentration of the copper content of the tailings. The tailings, of course, carry some copper, but not very much when you consider that the ore originally only contained a little over 1%. Nevertheless, he has recovered several thousand tons of copper concentrates a year from the tailings as they reached the ocean.
Right.
The fishermen in the area have had some problems with this. They think that the tailings have discouraged the fish. I understand that studies have indicated that, on the contrary, the tailings raise the temperature of the water around the mouth of the river sufficiently so the fish congregate there that want to warm themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that's true or not.
Depends on which side you want to believe.
Yes,
and,
but so far as I know, Sarco, or not Sarco, Southern Peru, is still disposing of its tailings in that fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Eel Smelter has had no facility so far for the recovery of sulfuric acid from the smelter smoke, most of which blows out to sea. There are only some olive groves in the neighborhood of Ilo. That's virtually the only agricultural activity. But there have been complaints from them regarding the effect of the sulfur on their crops. So as a result of the general movement toward improving the environment, Southern Peru recently has arranged financing and will be recovering sulfuric acid at the Ilo smelter, beginning, I suspect, within the next year or two.
What will they do with that?
Well, there is a large phosphate deposit which has not been actively mined in Peru, and it's perhaps the outcome of that is that the acid will be used in part for a fertilizer industry.
Mm-hmm.
But there is another outlet, and that is that as a result of installing this facilities for producing acid, Southern Peru is going forward with plants at both Cuajone and Tocopala to recover copper by the SXEW process, which requires sulfuric acid. So there will be some internal use of the acid. The acid will have to be shipped back up to the mines where it will be used. You know, the process involves dumping copper ores with oxide content and trickling acid through those dumps and precipitating out the copper.
So that would be a change in the technology up there.
Yes. Well, it will provide additional copper that is not now being produced.
Mr. Hochschild will lose out.
Well, no, because it isn't the tailings that will be used. This will be used for the waste material, which previously went on the dump because the copper content was too low to justify milling.
Oh, okay. So this is solvent extraction,
electrowinning.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. As you probably know, in the United States, for instance, at the Morenci mine, currently Phelps Dodge is producing more than half of all the copper it produces by SXEW.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That process has grown like wildfire in the last 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure we will see a lot of expansion of SXEW operations in Latin America, because they've been unknown there. They're just coming into focus in Chile, and there will be many more.
Mm-hmm. Well, that will be a happy solution to the problem then.
Unless it so overburdens the copper market that the price goes to the bottom.
There's always a problem in marketing,
yes.
Isn't there?
Yeah. So, a good deal of my time was really, other than just supervising what the sales policy of ASARCO should be with regard to its own production, a good deal of my time was spent on projects like Lake Asbestos in Southern Peru. But one of the important things, the anybody handling sales policy for a custom smelter has to do is he has to have one eye always on what a custom smelter calls intake. That is the amount of metal that you are buying. In the Sarcos case, that's determined month by month. We try to estimate how much material will be arriving in our smelter, let's say in the month of June. If the contract for the purchase of that material specifies that we pay for the copper contained in the concentrates at the average price for the month of June, we try to calculate how much that quantity would be for each of the mines that ship to us, whether they are our own mines, that is the Sarcos own mines, mm-hmm. or whether they are mines belonging to someone else. Because the smelters and the mines, even though owned by the same company, have to deal with each other mm-hmm. at arm's length on this for many reasons, one of them being tax purposes. When a U.S. company claims the depletion allowance, it has to be based on an assumption as to what the value of the copper is in the material as it leaves the mine and or mill, because really the mill is considered by the IRS as part of the mine. So you have to know what the value of the concentrates is. Theoretically, if an organization owning a smelter wanted to exaggerate its depletion allowance claims, the smelter would pay a lot for the concentrates and keep very little for its own processing charge. That would mean that the value of the concentrates would be higher and the 15% depletion allowance would apply against the large amount. On the other hand, if the smelter operator wants to make a big profit, of course he charges a lot for the processing. So the IRS looks with great care mm-hmm. at the contract between, let us say, the Mission Mine belonging to ASARCO and the Hayden Smelter belonging to ASARCO. Mm-hmm. What is the transfer price between the Mission Mine and the Hayden? Is it too high or too low, or is it right? Mm. The tendency is by custom smelters such as the Sarco to have the same processing charges to its own mines as they have to an outside shipper. Mm-hmm. Because let's say that Phelps Dodge is shipping some concentrates to the Mission, to the Hayden Smelter, which has happened from time to time. Well, Phelps Dodge is going to negotiate for the highest price it can, and of course, ASARCO is going to try to charge the highest fee it can. They eventually arrive at a deal. So that arrangement has been arrived as a result of two people serving their own self-interests, arriving at a negotiated price. Consequently, if the Hayden Smelter charges the Mission Mine the same processing fee that it has charged Phelps Dodge, that tends to satisfy the tax people mm. that it's an appropriate charge. Mm-hmm. I've gone into great length to explain that to you. Oh, but it is a very important part mm-hmm. of the custom smelting business. Mm-hmm. But the most important part from the standpoint of the sales department is not that we sell a lot, but that we sell everything for which we are paying that month's price. In other words, in the month of June, the best thing to do is to sell as much copper as you are buying in the month of June.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to balance it. We neither add to nor subtract from inventories. If we sell more, if a customer comes in and pleads with us, he has to have more. If we sell more to the customer, then we are buying from the suppliers. Then, the next month, if the price of copper has been going up, has gone up, we have lost. Because at the end of the year, the effort is always to have the same inventory on hand that you had at the beginning of the year. If you have a different inventory, if you have more inventory on hand at the end of the year than you had at the beginning of the year, then you've tied up the stockholders' capital. If you have less inventory on hand at the end of the year, you have sold out of what Asarco was called your iron inventories. That means the necessary inventories to carry the business, because you can't run the business with no inventory. There's always material going through the plant. It takes 3 months, roughly, from the time concentrates arrive at a smelter before refined copper is sold from the refinery. That 3 months is roughly equivalent to the inventory that the company has to be carrying.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the inventory covered, carried by a custom smelter, such as Asarco, may in fact date back on a cost basis as far as the pre-war period during the Depression. There may be some copper that is on the books at 9 cents a pound because it was the cost when the inventory was first put into place. Under the LIFO method, last in, first out method of inventory, if in a given year Asarco has sold more copper than it had purchased, that excess is deemed to have cost Asarco whatever it is on the books, and you pay an income tax profit, an income tax on that profit. Let's say that the copper was bought at 50 cents a pound. You sold it at 80 cents a pound, that's 30 cents a pound of profit, and you pay 30% or whatever the tax rate is in income tax. It can be an extremely expensive thing to oversell for somebody who's in the custom smelting business and uses LIFO.
Yeah. Now, I read somewhere that Asarco had made this LIFO inventory was a big breakthrough, that they were the first ones.
They were among the first to use it in the industry.
Were you involved in this?
No, this was before I came with the company.
There were two things that were mentioned as, one was the LIFO inventory, and I can't recall at the moment what the other thing was that Asarco introduced.
So, Asarco's inventory situation is watched like a by the management, like.
But Hawks. This was in place before you came with.
Oh yes, the procedure was in place.
I see.
I got to know all about it, talking with the controllers, other people in the tax department, and so it was almost the first thing that, when I was recruiting young people to come into the sales department, which really surprised me. I said, don't expect me to pat you on the back if you sell more than our target figure for the month, because it could be very expensive for the company for you to oversell.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, I'm not going to pat you on the back either if you sell less than we have taken in for the month. What we try to do each month is to sell the amount of material that we are pricing each month. And it's a, like walking a tight rope to do this. It's a juggling act. Now, some things can be done to balance the books. If we oversell to please a customer, we can perhaps go into the commodity exchanges and buy back an equivalent amount at the same price that we have oversold. If we have the physical metal and it makes the customer happy. But these are the finer points of sales management that one has to deal with. And as you recall, and I commented, I think it was yesterday, that in effect, the custom sales, the custom smelting business requires a greater degree of sophistication than just a company that is a straight producer. This is one of the reasons. The fact that you're constantly looking at the cost of materials on hand, month by month, not year by year. Yes. So we had a very good sales organization at the Sarco, in my judgment. The individual commodity managers were good. But what I took the greatest pride in, really, in many ways, was the skill of our foreign sales representative. When I assumed the responsibility, all our Mexican production was sold abroad, and it was very large in lead, zinc, small in copper, very substantial in silver. We were also was selling some material for Peru, and eventually the Southern Peru sales problem came along. And even though our sales representatives might be selling under instructions from Southern Peru management or from Mount Isa management, in effect, our sales agents in the major European countries represented not just ASARCO, but Mount Isa, Southern Peru, the Mexican operations, after Mexicanization, which happened in the late 50s, early 60s, when the control of ASARCO's Mexican properties passed to Mexican investors and ASARCO became a minority stockholder. Nevertheless, for a long time, the marketing operation continued under the general guidance of the New York